Good morning and welcome to the inaugural show of Cool Science Radio. Science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. We have a fascinating show for you this morning. Our first guest is Jeff Stibel, author of Breakpoint, Why the Web Will Implode, Search Will Be Obsolete, and Everything Else You Need to Know About Technology is in Your Brain. Jeff writes about the intersection of science, technology, and the complex networks that influence people's lives. Stibel, brain scientist and entrepreneur, compares the internet to the human brain as a network. And with all networks, the internet is approaching a breakpoint, along with many technologies and businesses that rely on it. Yet, as in nature, the breakpoint will bring better things because the fittest species are typically the smallest.
And good morning. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. It's nice to be here with you, John. Our second guest this morning is Lynn Ingram. She's the co-author of The West Without Water. Now, The West Without Water documents the tumultuous climate of the American West over 20 millennia, with tales of past droughts and deluges and predictions about the impacts of future climate change on water resources. Looking at the region's current water crisis from the perspective of its climate history, the author asks the central question of what is, quote, normal climate for the West and whether the relatively benign climate of the past century will continue into the future. We'll be speaking with both these authors and we'll get today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio on KPCW in Park City. We'll be back right after these messages.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Jan, I think I'm falling for the show.
John, are you hurt?
Nothing a little fun can't cure.
Fall into Fun on Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m.
Find out on Fun Friday what to do this fall. Brought to you by All Seasons Adventures,
Park Silly Sunday Market,
Zermatt Resort and Spa,
and the Homestead Resort.
No hosts were hurt in the making of this ad.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Our first guest is Jeff Stibel, author of Breakpoint, Why the Web Will Implode, Search Will Be Obsolete, and Everything Else You Need to Know About Technology is in Your Brain. It's a fascinating book. Jeff Stibel writes, "We are in the midst of a networking revolution set to transform the way we access world's information and the way we connect with one another. Studying biological systems is perhaps the best way to understand such networks, and nature has a lesson for us if we care to listen. Bigger is rarely better in the long run. The deadliest creature is the mosquito, not the lion. It's the quality of a network that is important for survival, not the size. And all networks, the human brain, Facebook, Google, even the internet itself, eventually reach a breakpoint and collapse. That's the bad news. The good news is that we're reaching a breakpoint. Reaching a breakpoint can be a step forward, allowing a network to substitute quality for quantity." Jeff, welcome to the inaugural show of Cool Science Radio.
John, Lynn, what an honor. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I also wanted to mention, Jeff is the president and CEO of the Dun & Bradstreet Credibility Corporation, chairman of BrainGate, as well as holding board seats for USC, Brown, and Tufts University. Jeff, first question, what can we learn from the biological networks of ants?
It's interesting. There is so much we can learn from biology in general, and it's often lost on people how applicable science is to the real world. And, you know, your question about ants is a great one, because when you look at ants as, you know, as a network, as a colony, they are incredibly sophisticated. But we tend to look at them when we're at a picnic, and they're trying to steal our food. So we look at it on an individual basis. And individual ants, they just aren't very smart. They have brains, but they're very rudimentary. They have, you know, a few neurons compared to the hundreds of billions that we have. But as a network, they do incredibly sophisticated things. So colonies of ants actually invented air conditioning hundreds of millions of years before humans did. They invented complex architecture. They invented warfare. I shouldn't say this, but they invented slavery. Slavery was an ant phenomena before it was a human phenomena. So there is so much that we can learn about ants and, frankly, other social insects. And when it comes to our brains, there's also a lot that we can learn because ants are effectively complex networks in the same way that our brains are. So brains aren't singular. They're composed of neurons connected to one another. And ants actually behave very similarly to the way the human brain does. And we're seeing a lot of our technology evolve in that way as well.
And everything you mentioned about ants being architects, putting air conditioning together, inventing war, the slavery, all the different complex pieces that make up their environment, the one piece that I just found fascinating was that they know when they hit a critical mass, when they hit a certain size, that is the optimum size, and then they decide not to grow any further. They go out and they start other colonies, but can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. And I'll caveat this by saying they in the ants is the system as a whole, the network. No individual ant knows much of anything. But the network actually learns and has memory because ants in general, with most species, an individual ant only lasts for about a year. But the colony can last for up to 20 years. And it's the colony intelligence that gets smarter and smarter as the network grows and then eventually hits a breakpoint and collapses. And the parallels are remarkable when you look at the human brain. So our brains grow up until about the age of 5, and then we implode. So we get about 100 trillion connections amongst our neurons from the age of 0 to the age of 5 years old. And then a remarkable thing happens. We lose almost 90% of those connections. And in losing those connections, we actually gain intelligence. And that's where this is so relevant to our technologies today. So what we see is ants shrink and they grow wiser. The human brain shrinks and it grows wiser. So when you look at things like MySpace and Facebook and the Internet and other technologies that are evolving today as networks, as social networks, it should come as no surprise that if they grow and grow and grow out of control, they will eventually be unusable. They will be so cluttered that they just won't have much value. So the premise and thesis behind the book Breakpoint is really that all networks collapse, comma, and that's a good thing, not a bad thing. That's where wisdom comes from. That's where intelligence comes from. That's where usability comes from. And you see this all over nature. But we seem to fight this within humankind. As we build and create our technologies, we constantly think that bigger is better. And unfortunately, because of that, most of our technologies and most of our businesses go the way that other big biological systems have gone. They grow extinct, just like the dinosaurs.
So really, Jeff, it's about adapting. You call it a couple different things in your book, but it's about getting to that breakpoint. Growth happens incredibly quickly, whether you're looking at ants or the human brain or Facebook. It grows quickly. You get to the breakpoint, and then it's about what happens after the breakpoint. How you adapt depends on where it determines whether or not you're going to collapse or create an equilibrium.
That is so true, Lynn. And the underlying thesis is that Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell had nothing on Charles Darwin when it comes to invention and ingenuity. The reality is, it comes from adaptive design. And what you need to be able to do is you need to start by growing as quickly as possible. And this is what we all know in the technology world. It's called hypergrowth. Get bigger and bigger and bigger, faster and faster and faster. But there comes a time where you have to adapt because your network grows too large. It becomes too cumbersome. At that point, just like the ants, just like the human brain, just like most other biological systems, you have to allow that network to shrink so that it can become more usable. And, with ants, the reason why it has to shrink is because they communicate using chemicals like pheromones. And at some point, when you have too many ants, you've got too much smell, and you can't make sense of all of those scents. so you can't communicate well. When it comes to the human brain, the neurons communicate using electrical and chemical charges. At some point, it becomes too cluttered. When it comes to the internet, it's, again, electrical charges. And once you hit that breakpoint, the internet can become more like the superhighway analogy that we tend to use. And a crowded superhighway is of no use to us because you end up in a traffic jam. And then the same thing is true with social networks, although as opposed to it being computers and electricity, it's humans. Too many humans on a social network cause the exact same collapse that would happen with the internet, with the human brain, with ants, with termites and cockroaches, or any other networked biological system.
But so you're saying, Jeff, that it takes a certain amount of failure so you know where the breakdown is in order to move to the next step. And maybe I should ask you about a company like MySpace, for example, that took that failure but didn't do a lot with it, right? Because we don't have MySpace anymore. And then compare that to a company like Netflix that constantly adapts.
Yes. And you know, it's not just about innovation. When we say adapt, what we mean here is adapt to the environment at hand. We don't just mean innovate and move beyond. And MySpace, I'm concerned about using MySpace as an example because I suspect many listeners don't even remember what MySpace was. But for those who do and don't, MySpace was the first robust large social network. They were so dominant that when Facebook came on the scene, everyone assumed it was impossible for another social network to make any ground. And MySpace was growing at record levels. It went from 20 million users to 50 million users. Then it broke 100 million users. And each time it continued to grow, you could see signs of it cracking. And I remember for Harvard Business Review, I wrote an article back in 2007 saying that MySpace was going to implode. And the editors thought I was crazy. How could you say that? This is the fastest growing thing ever. I said, well, no, that's not true. The human brain grows faster in its infancy. Ants and colonies grow faster in its infancy. And they all collapse. And if one of two things happens when you hit this collapse, if you allow for the collapse, and that's that adaptation, that's what these great companies and great entrepreneurs are so good at, what you do is you increase the strength and the power and the wisdom of your network. If you don't, what you're gonna have is an epic failure. And that's what happened with MySpace. And for those of us who remember being on MySpace, you went from one friend to 10 friends to 100 friends to 1,000 friends to stop calling them friends. And, you know, all of a sudden, your mother's cousin's aunt's little sister keeps posting pictures about her cat. Who cares? And at that point, the network is no longer valuable.
But isn't that what's happening with Facebook now? I mean, how is Facebook adapting now? How is it changing so that it stays relevant, unlike MySpace?
Well, it's a really good point, Lynn, because we are seeing the same signs of cracking on Facebook, particularly in the United States, that MySpace was seeing back in 2006 and 2007. The difference is that I believe that Facebook and many of the executives at Facebook understand this theory, understand the problem, and are working to resolve it. So if you remember, I said earlier how no one thought that a little network called Facebook could ever do anything against MySpace. I thought differently. And the reason I thought differently was because what Facebook was doing was creating networks of networks. Rather than going after a big, broad base, they were saying, let's come up with these hyper networks where we can dominate, and then move on to the next one when it hits its breakpoint. So Facebook started off just at Harvard. You had to have a Harvard ID to get in. Then Ivy League schools. Then it went to all colleges. Then to all schools and businesses. It took 3 years before the average individual was even allowed to log on to Facebook. 3 years. So they grew in a measured way. Now, at this point, Facebook is exploding with hypergrowth. And in many markets, they have grown too big because I'm seeing those same pictures of cats that I saw 5 or 6 years ago on MySpace.
I think
and
the
Facebook.
Oh, go ahead.
No, please, John.
I was going to say that one of the fundamental challenges is, as you point out in the book, is that the average person can manage about 150 friends or acquaintances, and the average Facebook user has 262 friends.
Yes, and that stat, even though the book came out a couple weeks ago, is already out of date. It's larger than that. And, you know, that number, it's called Dunbar's number, which is a psychological phenomena. It basically shows that the brain itself can only handle that many social connections. There is nothing our technology can do to extend that reach. So once you go beyond that, whether you're leveraging technology, whether you have, you know, just a little black book, or, you know, whether you're using your own memory, once you go beyond that point, the network of friends that you have will become more and more diminished. So Facebook being above that level is a critical pivot point. And, you know, I would call it a break point. And the good news is they are doing a lot to try to curtail this now.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Jeff Stibel. He's the author of the new book, Breakpoint, talking about why the web will implode, search will be obsolete, and everything else you need to know about technology is in your brain.
There's a tremendous amount of buzz for this book, Jeff. A lot of people talking about it, and the reviews have been fantastic. I just wanted to mention that to our audience. And I also wanted to mention that probably a lot of people don't understand how the internet has been able to scale with all of our needs. I believe you mentioned in your book that the average family in 2012 generates traffic that would represent about 5% of total internet traffic back in 2008. That means that 20 families would completely saturate the capacity of the internet today if we were using the capacity back in 2008. I think I got that right, didn't I?
You absolutely did, and what a phenomenally fascinating statistic. Cisco actually did a report on this about a year back, and when you think about it from that perspective, right? I mean, it really brings the point home, no pun intended, because you know our average homes in North America represent 5% of the internet just a few years ago, and you don't think about what you're actually doing at home that could be using so much of the internet, but the amount of throughput that we're using, whether it comes from our computers, which is the obvious one, or phones, but also through things like our microwaves, many of them are connected to the internet, our cameras, our cars, our pets, our refrigerators. You know, there are refrigerators now that log onto the internet and can tell you when you're low on milk. So, I mean, the amount of throughput that is going through the internet right now is almost something that is too hard to understand. I mean, people have trouble actually thinking about just how big the internet has gotten and how much it continues to accelerate.
Absolutely. And the internet has been able to scale, and the proliferation of the mobile devices and people having multiple devices. I mean, there's so many things that have contributed to this, including a lot of streaming that's going on. But I think our listeners are curious as to what the future will be for the search experience. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And search is a really interesting phenomenon because most people can't live without Google. Google has become largely synonymous with search. The reason is because search is such a key function of any network. There really can only be one, effectively a monopoly. And it's the same in the brain. I mean, we don't have multiple areas of search regions. You need one. It's a portal or a gateway into the world of a particular network. And Google has largely taken over and dominated in that arena. But the reality is search is not the best vehicle to find things within a network. In the early days, search wasn't even prominent. Yahoo actually started out not as a search engine, but as a list. It was actually originally called Jerry's Guide to the Web. And it was just a list of the best sites on the internet. And, you know, what ended up happening, the web just got too big for that. And eventually, search evolved. However, search works when you've got a large network of information, but not too large. And that's where we've gotten now. So, you know, for those of the listeners who go on Google, I suspect very few of them, once they search for something, ever leave the first page of results. But there are typically millions of pages of results. What that effectively means is search is not doing an adequate job. And that's because we have too much information on the World Wide Web now. So instead of needing to search, we effectively need to filter. And filtering comes more with a conversation than it does with a search box. And that's why I think Siri from Apple was so innovative. You know, this was a technology where you could literally talk to the application, and it would go and search and find for you. And then you'd have effectively a conversation. It's in its infancy. It doesn't work particularly well. Half the time it is way off the mark. But that is largely where we're headed. We're going to start having conversations with our computers and our devices as opposed to barking orders at it.
So we're going to move away from key terms. I know this has been a frustration with people who are not native, who didn't grow up with the internet, who are kind of coming to it. They don't know how to search because they use incorrect key terms. But what you're saying is we're going to evolve away from that completely and into just asking it, you know, asking it more intuitive questions, really.
That is exactly right, Lynn. And if you remember the early days of search, there was a site called Ask Jeeves.
Yes.
Ask Jeeves largely had the right idea. Ask me a question, I'll find you the answer. The problem was that the technology wasn't there. Effectively, what Ask Jeeves did was said, ask me a question. Where can I find Labrador puppies in California? And what Jeeves would do is it would cut out all of the quote-unquote garbage words and create keywords. Well, that doesn't really do it for us. So now what's going to happen when you ask Jeeves or you ask Siri or you ask the Internet is the Internet will use that information in a conversational way, parsing the linguistic elements in the same way that humans do. And we'll know exactly what you mean when you say, can I have a cup of Java? And we won't send you to the island in Malaysia.
Right. Jeff, can you tell us about the crowdsourcing community and what that may mean to us in the future?
Sure. And it's a great question, John, because it comes right back to your initial question about ants. Right? I mean, effectively, what we're talking about with crowdsourcing is leveraging the wisdom of the crowd, so to speak, the collective network intelligence as opposed to individual intelligence. And, we have seen, and it's been documented over and over again, that large bodies of people can make amazing predictions. They can do incredibly, incredibly sophisticated things. And what we're seeing with the Internet is it is becoming an enabling technology for us to crowdsource things like information and funding and lending, and to do so in an incredibly efficient way. So I'll give you an example that sits very close to home for me. I run a very large credit business where we issue, manage, monitor, and help businesses build their credit and credibility. And this has historically been done using back-end data. When you develop new scores, such as our DNB Paydex score, it's based on information in terms of what has happened in the ecosystem. A business, let's say Joe's Pizza, does business with other businesses, pays on time. They look very credit worthy, and we can determine that by pulling information from banks, from credit cards, from partners and vendors and other sources. Well, now we've got the opportunity to leverage the crowd for that information, so that we don't have to worry about our selective attention, thinking that it's these five banks or it's these three vendors. We don't have to worry about self-selecting the wrong information. We can focus on leveraging the crowd to get ubiquitous information, and that means now we can get information from customers, from complaints, from reviews, and you can bundle all of that in and get a much stronger result, whether you're talking about a credit score, whether you're talking about figuring out whether someone is credible, and possibly even whether you figure out whether this is your mate for life and you're trying to fall in love on Match.com. You can use the crowd to help determine whether you're the right match.
Jeff, I wanted to ask you, you have lots of connection to universities, and one of my quandaries is about the way that our youth evolves within technology. It's a different way than we do, you know, as not to say that we're not in our youth, but, you know, I look at my kids and I'm seeing them evolve away from Facebook. They're evolving towards Instagram. And I'm wondering, is it that their minds have been trained to think in terms of little, you know, blips, you know, shorter amounts of text? Why are they evolving away from Facebook and into Instagram, which to me is just a bunch of pictures?
Sure. And it's a great question, Lynn, because it's leading in a number of respects. The great irony, of course, is Instagram is Facebook now because they bought them. And they bought them because they saw the exact same trend that you did. Had you been there, you'd have been worth billions of dollars.
Dang it.
Because you're seeing that same thing, that same insight that, you know, that the leaders at Facebook saw. That is a relatively natural phenomena. You know, I will say at a high level, our brains are changing. You know, as we interact with the environment around us, that environment does affect our brains. Our brains, too, adapt, just like technology. They're malleable, and they learn. And as we get more packets of information as opposed to large pieces of information from the Twitters and Instagram and Facebooks of the world, our brain comes to expect that and comes to cherish it. And we actually get endorphins and dopamine. Almost the equivalent of bits of heroin going through our brain when we see information that is actually positive and proactive and useful. And when that information is shorter, more consistently, we get more dopamine from shorter bits of information versus larger bits of information, and that changes our brains. Now, the flip side of that is there have been a lot of people saying the internet is changing our brain, and that is a bad thing. And that I fundamentally disagree with. And we have seen since the dawn of time with each new technology, you know, pundits coming out and saying, this is changing our brains, that means it's bad. No, that means we're evolving. And, you know, the earliest record of that was from the written word. And it was Socrates himself who said the written word is effectively evil. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why we know very little about Socrates. He refused to write any of his thoughts down because he thought it was changing his brain.
Well, as you point out in the book, it's the printing press, electricity, the telephone. There's tremendous pushback at every juncture there. Jeff,
exactly.
We would love to spend the rest of the morning with you having and continuing this conversation, but unfortunately we have run out of time. But we are speaking with Jeff Stibel, who is the author of a fascinating book, Breakpoint: Why the Web Will Implode, Search Will Be Obsolete, and Everything Else You Need to Know About Technology is in Your Brain. Jeff, you are our absolute first guest on Cool Science Radio. We would like to invite you back on our one-year anniversary to rejoin us.
You know, I would be honored, John and Lynn. What a great show, and I'm excited to be a longtime listener as the show evolves and grows and becomes a huge success.
Thank you, and the very best of luck to you, Jeff.
Okay, thank you both.
Thanks, Jeff. And you're listening to Cool Science Radio right here on KPCW. We'll be right back with today's cool story. Stay with us.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves Chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly at 5:30 p.m. You can contact us at 649-3140. Our website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
And welcome back to the inaugural program, Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, today's cool story, as we'll do every program, involves a little competition for Dick Tracy. It's about wearable computing.
You know, as a kid, Lynn, I never liked Dick Tracy, but man, did I like his wristwatch. He could do anything. And of course, for 70 years, we've been waiting for that wristwatch. I believe it's arrived with Samsung's announcement yesterday of the Gear, which is a wristwatch which interfaces to the smartphone and allows you to place calls and to be able to do that with voice commands, to receive messages, calendar alerts, just about anything that your smartphone does, you're going to be able to have that interface to this new wristwatch, a wearable item, part of, you know, it's an accessory.
That's right. I mean, I can't imagine this thing. Well, I can, because currently we have wristwatches that are GPSs that do take our heart rates, all kinds of things. But this is an additional. It just has to interface with that smartphone. And now we know that Apple's heard of this, and they're getting a little nervous. They're expected to release their own smartwatch. However, Samsung's is the first to announce the release. It'll be ready to go for the holiday season.
Ready for the holiday season, and I believe they already have 70 apps that have been written specifically for this wristwatch. And if you're thinking about who's going to be the 400-pound gorilla out there, is it going to be Google, Microsoft, Facebook? Who's it going to be? Well, keep your eye on Samsung. That is a company that continues to innovate.
That's right. And you're listening to Cool Science Radio. We'll be back in just a minute with Lynn Ingram. She's the co-author of The West Without Water. Stay with us.
Many know that Botox can help with migraines, but don't know where to turn for qualified headache care. Locally board-certified doctors at Park City Specialty East can help ease the life-altering headaches with Botox. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization, 435-658-7470.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Our next guest is Lynn Ingram. She's a co-author of The West Without Water, What Past Floods, Droughts, and Other Climatic Clues Tell Us About Tomorrow. Now, this book merges climate and paleoclimate research from a wide variety of sources as it introduces readers to key discoveries in cracking the secrets of the region's climatic past. It demonstrates that extended droughts and catastrophic floods have plagued the West with regularity over the past two millennia, and it recounts the most disastrous flood in the history of California and the West, occurring in the 1800s. Now, the authors show that while the West may have temporarily buffered itself from such harsh climatic swings by creating artificial environments and human landscapes, our modern civilization may actually be ill-prepared for what the future holds. And Lynn Ingram is now joining us by phone. Good morning to you, Lynn.
Oh, good morning.
It's nice to have you on. And I guess I just want to start by asking the question. You've looked back over millennia. And really, is it the further that we look back at climate, is it really the more it's telling us about what the future holds?
In some ways, yes, because we can start to see the patterns of climate, and we see that there's cycles of wet and dry. You know, there's periods of extreme flood and droughts that that occur maybe every couple of centuries, or even every 1 to 2 millennia. That if we didn't look far enough in the past, we never would really understand, you know, this kind of variability, because we only really have the past century or 150 years of recorded climate, you know, instrumental records of climate.
That's right. So right now, you know, I've heard it said here in Utah, we're in a 3-year drought, for example. But you talk in your book about I think it was the 12th century, there was a drought that lasted 20 years. I mean, what does this mean for us?
Well, I mean, the scary thing, it means that, you know, if these kinds of events have occurred before, they can occur again. I mean, this is something the climate has done before, and there's no reason that it couldn't recur. And back during the medieval period,
about 1,050 to 550 years ago, it was, you know, it was also warmer. So it was called the medieval warm period as well, as another name for that. And so the concern is that as we continue to warm the climate, you know, we could be re-enter a period of drier conditions that would produce these longer droughts.
Lynn, your description of the flooding in California in 1861 and 1862, it reads like a made-for-TV movie of widespread suffering and the impact to virtually every creature from San Diego to 200 miles north of San Francisco. If you could just take a minute and tell us about this flood and the chain of events that occurred.
Yeah, so the flood, what happened is it started in December of 1860, and there were 43 days of almost continuous rain, and it was produced by a series of storms coming from the tropics called atmospheric rivers. So there are these narrow corridors of water vapor that come up from the tropics to the mid-latitudes that carry, you know, 10 to 20 Mississippi River worth of water in just a few days. But in this case, it was, you know, back-to-back atmospheric river storms that lasted 43 days. And so it pretty much inundated not just California, but all the way from Canada down to the Mexican border. And so, you know, and inland, too, including Nevada, Arizona, and Utah, you know, there's accounts of diary and different kinds of accounts that, you know, this was a really catastrophic flood inland as well. So they sort of make their way inland. And so just, you know, inundation of the Central Valley, which is, you know, 200 to 300 miles long and 20 to 50 miles wide, and covering the telegraph poles, so, you know, at least 10 feet deep. Sacramento was under 10 to 20 feet of water for several months.
Wow.
Yeah, Southern California, Mojave Desert has accounts of, you know, huge floods and being under at least 4 feet of water in the Southern California region.
So people got wiped out, horses got wiped out. I mean, it just affected everyone on land, but it also affected the fish, because as the water started to drain into San Francisco Bay, it changed the salinity, and as a result of that, the photoplankton couldn't survive that salinity change, and then the fish didn't have the photoplankton to feed on. And I mean, it's just one thing after another. I mean, it was just an extraordinary climatic event.
Right. The entire San Francisco Bay turned into essentially a freshwater lake, and just, you know, wiped out. There were oyster farms that were wiped out, and like you said, the ecosystems collapsed in the bay. So it was, it was a really extreme event, and the state went bankrupt and wiped out, I think, 250,000 cattle were killed, and, you know, human lives were taken, estimated a few thousand, perhaps.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you, Lynn, about, okay, so say we take that 1860, 1861 flood in California, and we know now that when we're speaking of climate change, we're talking about weather extremes. So what else do you know that was going on at that point in the world that represents the other extreme? Like, what historically, was there a drought somewhere else?
Oh, you mean during the 1861?
Yeah. And I'm just using that as an example, and maybe you can address other times where there are these extremes.
I actually don't know during 1861 if there were. I mean, there was. I believe there were cooler conditions during that time in places, but I don't know if there were elsewhere were droughts, or if it was just that there was this series of atmospheric river storms that just got fixated on the West Coast, and, you know, it's just one of those kind of events that brought a lot of moisture from the tropics.
Right. And so, I guess I'm wondering here in, I don't know if you're familiar with Park City, Utah, but, we live in a ski resort town, so we're all about the snow. And during, the past years of climate change, it seems like, what we've heard is that the extremes are going to happen. We've had a couple really dry years with snow. However, our neighbors to the way north up in Canada have been getting dumped on. And, it's kind of this polarity, this polarization of, not everyone's just getting a normal amount of snow. We get none, they get a bunch.
And right. Because in some cases, if you have a shift of the storm track, or you have these different oceanic conditions, like, for instance, El Nino, La Nina conditions, where the Northwest will be dry, the Southwest will be wetter, or during the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, you'll see this polarity as well, where the Northwest will be wetter, the Southwest drier, or vice versa. So you're right. There are these kind of extremes that are geographically sort of predictable in that sense, yeah.
Lynn, let's talk about the future. I read in your book that climate scientists at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography have estimated that within a decade, there's a 50% chance that Lake Mead will drop below the reservoir's outlets. What does that mean for the West? What's it mean for the Colorado River? What does it mean for us in Park City?
Well, I mean, it's a very serious situation. I mean, the Colorado River Basin supports, water for 30 million people, and hydropower and so on. And they're predicting a 10 to 30% reduction in runoff by 2050. So, and also a decrease in snowpack in the Colorado River Basin in the next 30 to 50 years. So, it will, it will be something that we'll have to start preparing for now, and just in terms of, increased things like water conservation and water recycling, reducing our water footprint, that kind of thing, and reconsidering what crops we're growing in which areas. We don't want to be growing water-intensive crops like cattle feed and rice and cotton in areas that are, going to be facing these kind of declines in precipitation.
Well, that all sounds good. But, when I go out to Heber or Midway, Utah, and I see all the house lots that are being built, and I know the expansion of some of these other smaller and larger cities in the West. I mean, people continue to move here. People continue to use resources. I mean, what really is going to happen? What are the possibilities? Are we equipped to handle what Mother Nature may hand us?
Well, I mean, what all the experts are saying in terms of the experts that are looking at water policy and trying to plan for the future, that we really do have to start considering, before developing in certain areas, consider the water resources that are available to that area, and use and be more intelligent about where we develop and how we're expanding now, because we have this false sense of security about water, because up until now we have reservoirs, we have aqueducts and canals that are bringing water where we need it, and we have plentiful groundwater that's been sort of buffering the droughts and providing water when we need it. But the groundwater table is falling. We're starting to deplete groundwater seriously, And so I think at some point we're going to kind of reach a critical point where, you know, we won't have that groundwater to fall back on. And groundwater is actually, at least in California, it's not even regulated yet, which doesn't make sense at all. So I think there's people that are looking at these kind of policies and trying to come up with better ways of pricing water by factoring in water scarcity and the environmental costs of water into the price structure, so that we have more efficient use of water and things like drought tolerant landscaping, water recycling, just especially agriculture, more efficient agriculture.
What we find here, Lynn, is that there's a lot of lip service paid to that. But the bottom line is, if you're paying so much more to create, municipalities and water companies, if they're paying so much more to create an infrastructure to bring more water in, they've got to sell that water. So they don't really want you to conserve. And I think that's, that's the short-term picture. And it must be difficult for someone like you, who is a paleoclimatologist, and by the way, how do you define the paleoclimatologist? Difficult word.
I'm just impressed that Lynn was able to say it.
I didn't say it right.
That was awesome, Lynn. That was really good.
Thanks.
Yeah. It's the basic definition is just a scientist who studies the climate of the past and
the long past.
Right. And so, to be honest, my main training was in geology and studying sediment cores and studying, looking at fossils and the chemistry of the fossils to say, what were conditions like in the past? Was it warmer? Was it cooler? But it's sort of like a detective using clues buried in these sediments. And sometimes it's hard to really, you really need to start comparing from different regions to see if what you're getting is actually true, because you're simply looking at this evidence that you're trying to unravel in either it's tree rings or it's sediment cores from the ocean or from lakes. And, it's a very inexact science in a lot of ways. And so we really have to start looking at, comparing our records with others to kind of confirm or not that we're really getting the right story.
Okay, Lynn, so we have these records that go back 150 years. Tell us what the temperature was 149 years ago, or rainfall, or this or that. And you've been able to go out using forensic clues from gnarled trees and sediments and abandoned settlements, and you've been able to go back 20,000 years. What's the takeaway when you take a look at the history over the last 20,000 years and for us here in the West? Have what we've seen over the last 150 years, is that what you would call normal? Is it possible for us to have something even more catastrophic? What's the takeaway from your research?
Well, the takeaway is that there are these broader cycles, that like roughly 200-year cycles. There's also a 55 and a 90-year cycle. And we've been in a generally wetter part of that cycle. But, if you continue on, what we would expect is that we would head into a drier period, because the climate just naturally fluctuates between wet and dry. And so, that's the kind of the normal pattern that we've seen, at least over the last few thousand years. And so, in some ways we think of the last 150 years and think, oh, that's a really long time. We know that things are a certain way. And so stepping back, you can kind of see that we're just part of this larger cycle. And then on top of that, we've got this climate warming going on that's going to affect the climate in certain ways, make it drier, make the extremes more, actually floods should get larger at the same time. So we're superimposing both of those. In terms of what that will look like, it's hard to say because, what humans are doing now is like a big experiment that's never been really done before. So, you know, there's some uncertainty as to how it's going to come out. But
and I guess that's a question that we all want to ask, which of course involves, you know, politics and very current issues involving climate change. We always want to refer to or ask the scientists, those who are really looking at the long patterns. You know, why is climate changing? Part of it is the pattern. Part of it are these other factors, which are not just human related, but you have a chapter in your book all about why climate changes. Maybe you want to go over a few of those with us.
Okay, so why climate naturally changes?
Yeah, I mean, and how much humans factor into the change? You know, does a human, does our use and our impact and our carbon footprint factor in more than, say, volcanic activity?
Right, right. Well, so there's different timescales of climate change, and in the book we talk about, you know, there's glacial interglacial cycles. So those there's a 100,000-year cycle, a 40,000-year cycle, and a 20,000-year cycle. And so those cycles are kind of going along in the background. And 20,000 years ago, we were at the sort of the peak of an ice age. So since then, we've rapidly come out of the ice age into a interglacial. And then we see these shorter-term cycles superimposed on that, that are thought to be related to sunspot cycles. So there's about a 1,500-year cycle and a 200-year cycle and 90 and 55-year cycles that are related to solar activity that somehow affect the hydrologic cycle and the atmosphere that then impact, you know, where water is falling and that sort of thing. And it's complicated. That's still being researched. But then there's also appear to be cycles in the frequency and strength of things like El Nino events. So there were periods in the past when there were more frequent and larger El Niños and periods when La Niña was more dominant. And so when El Niño is more dominant, you have the Southwest is wetter. And when La Niña is more dominant, it's drier. And so, you know, that's another thing. And then there's this specific decadal oscillation that's more like a 50 to 70-year cycle of wet and dry that's related to conditions in the North Pacific. So it really seems like the Pacific Ocean and being so large and, you know, the temperature conditions and how they change over the Pacific Ocean affects us in the West. It affects the amount of evaporation and so the source of water and then the storm tracks and how that water is carried inland and where it falls in the West.
Wow. So it really, Lynn, is such a conundrum when you're looking at all the different cycles and which one you're looking at and everything has to be factored in. And it's very complex. And that's why you've written this book, The West Without Water, What Past Floods, Droughts, and Other Climatic Clues Tell Us About Tomorrow. And Lynn Ingram, thank you so much for your time today.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Again, that was Lynn Ingram, The West Without Water. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Lost and Found. Traffic, weather, and local stories. Only in Park City. Only on KPCW. This is KPCW Park City.
And we want to thank our guests today on Cool Science Radio, Jeff Stiebel and Lynn Ingram. We also want to thank our very, very competent producer, Beth Fratkin, for her help in putting the show together.